Yeah, so thank you for the introduction, and thanks for inviting me. So today I'm going to tell you about my work on the triangular lattice Hubbard model, and I'll convince you, hopefully, that there is indeed a chiral spin liquid phase of this model. So I'll start with a brief motivation, and then I'll discuss methods that I use for this computation, and then I'll show you the phase diagram of the model and provide evidence for that there's the three phases, including a metallic phase, a non-magnetic insulating phase, and a spin-ordered phase. And then I'll identify the non-magnetic insulating phase as a chiral spin liquid, after which I'll give some implications for experiments and summarize the results, and then talk about some future directions. So I think about this problem partially as sort of an experimental puzzle. In 2003, there was a paper measuring this organic crystal, which is approximately described as an isotropic triangular lattice. And the result was that there's essentially no magnetic ordering down to the very lowest temperatures. And you can compare this material, which follows this line with the blue ellipse around the points at low temperature, versus a similar triangular lattice material, but slightly different one. And what I'm showing here is magnetic susceptibility as a function of temperature. And you can see for this material, the points circled in red, this rapidly increases at low temperature, indicative of some sort of magnetic ordering. And that doesn't happen in this material. So that's some sign that it might be some kind of spin liquid that's in this material. But the actual state is pretty unclear. So even the basic question of whether it's gapped or gapless in low energy excitations is actually unsettled. So heat capacity measurements have found that the heat capacity has a linear in T behavior at low temperature, which is shown, this axis here is heat capacity divided by temperature. So the fact that it doesn't go to zero shows a sort of metallic type of gapless behavior. On the other hand, thermal transport data seems to suggest that the thermal conductivity divided by temperature goes to zero. In other words, this appears to be gapped. So this is sort of a strange conundrum. And so it's an open question, what exactly is the nature of this state? OK, so it's going to be some kind of a spin liquid that is something that is has no magnetic order down to low temperatures. But what exactly that is unclear. So the original picture of spin liquids is like this resonating valence bond state from Anderson. And this has been this, I guess, sort of famous picture captures the same idea, is basically that spins are in some disordered liquid state. But the more modern perspective involves fractionalization and topology and so forth. And there's various candidate states we might have, including gapless states, such as U1 spin liquid with spin on Fermi surface, Dirac spin liquid with some gapless Dirac cones, or other types of nodal gapless spin liquids with, for example, quadratic band touching. And there's various gapped states, such as the Z2 spin liquid, which is the torque code state, or the chiral spin liquid, which has time reversal symmetry breaking and gapless edge modes, and is the spin analog of the fractional quantum Hall nu equals 1/2 state. And I'll say more about that later. OK, so to try to answer which one of these different types of spin liquids actually appears, we need to somehow model this material. So the crystal structure, as I said, looks approximately like a triangular lattice. And since there's electrons here, a reasonable model is the Hubbard model, with some hopping between sites and then some on-site repulsion U. There are various estimates for what these parameters should be to accurately model this material. So this original paper this is from estimated quite isotropic lattice, and U over T is around 8. Some later estimates from DFT calculations have shown a slightly more anisotropic hopping and a slightly larger U, but it's somewhat similar. However, the Hubbard model can be quite difficult to study, and so it might be beneficial to look at a sort of simpler model, like a spin model, which you can get by doing a T over U expansion. So let's first see what happens if you do that. So there's quite a few existing results on such spin models, which include various terms, the nearest neighbor Heisenberg interaction, second neighbor Heisenberg interaction, ring exchange, and some scalar chiral term, they're shown here on the lattice. And as you add these terms, you find different low energy phases. So just with the nearest neighbor Heisenberg by itself, this is known to have this 120 degree spin ordering in the ground state. If we then add the second neighbor interaction, there's various candidates for what might happen. So I'm just showing one example here. There's a DMRG paper, which shows that as you increase this J2, you go from the ordered state into some gapped spin liquid, and then into a different ordered state. But there are other studies with other methods that have found gapless spin liquids and such as well. We can also add these ring exchanges to get a somewhat more realistic picture. And there's lots of studies that do this. So one is a variational approach from Motronic, which finds a gapless spin on Fermi surface. And similar things have been found using DMRG on a few-leg ladder, for example, by Donna Sheng. And then another picture is that you can get this nodal gapless spin liquid with various other phases in a quite complex phase diagram. So there's a lot of phases that are similar in energy. And then if you explicitly add this chiral term, which breaks time reversal symmetry, then even just a very small amount of that compared with J1 will give you this chiral spin liquid phase. So what you see is that there's tons of different phases that are all basically at low energy and competing with each other. And therefore, it really is worth it to study the full Hubbard model. There are some existing studies of this. But first, people have just tried to analyze this using spin models in the expansion, like I said, including to 12th order in one paper. But the results are still pretty unclear from doing that. There's a two-leg ladder DMRG study where they add some extra longer-range interactions, and they find looks like a gapless spin liquid. And then there is exactly one study before the one done by myself and my collaborators of DMRG on some larger finite cylinder. And they find the expected three phases, a metal, a spin liquid, and an ordered phase. And with evidence from just looking directly at the derivative of energy with respect to U, they find two first order transitions. And they identify these phases as the metal and the ordered phase from the spin structure factor primarily. And then there's like a partial spin ordering or something in the middle. So then they say it's kind of like a spin liquid. But the nature of that is very unclear.
So here you wrote the low Fermi surface that doesn't mean spin on the surface.
They claim there is no spin on Fermi surface, but that it may be gap. It may be gapless at various nodes, but that it's not a full gapless Fermi surface. Okay, so we're going to continue on from this picture and try to give a better understanding of what this intermediate state actually is. Okay, so next I'll talk briefly about the calculation methods that I use. So I'm going to use the DMRG, or density matrix renormalization group. In particular, I use the infinite system variety. So what that is, it's a variational method within a particular class of states. That's this matrix product state ansatz. In particular, since I'm using the infinite system variant of DMRG, they're translationally invariant matrix product states with a repeating unit cell. So what a matrix product state is you write your wave function in terms of some set of local basis states with the coefficient written as a product of matrices. So each of these ai is some rank 3 tensor, which has dimensions d by chi by chi. D is the physical dimension corresponding to these labels of the basis states. And then chi is so-called MPS bond dimension, which controls the accuracy of this approximation. So this is typically represented in this graphical form. Each circle represents one of these tensors. And then each line coming out from the circle is one of these indices. And a connected line indicates some tensor contraction. So what's important to realize about these matrix product states is that they're essentially an approximation on the amount of entanglement in the state. And the maximum entanglement I can have across some cut is the log of this bond dimension chi. As a consequence, if I know how much entanglement I expect to have, then the bond dimension I need to use is going to scale with the exponential of that entanglement. And consequently, this matrix product state is going to be an efficient representation of a so-called area loss state in one dimension. This is a state where if I take some region of length L, and I look at the entanglement between that region and the rest of the system, it's going to not scale with L. It's going to be a constant. That means I can use only a finite bond dimension and have a good description. OK, but now I want to apply this to a two-dimensional system, namely the triangular lattice. So to do that, we need to use some sort of finite strip so it can become quasi-one-dimensional, and then put on some order in the sites. So for example, here, I can just follow the order of these arrows through the lattice, and that'll give me my effective one-dimensional system that I'm looking at. There are some consequences of putting this system on a cylinder. One is that you discretize momenta in the Brillouin zone. So the full Brillouin zone of this lattice is a hexagon. And then once I go to the cylinder, I have only a discrete translation invariance in the direction around the cylinder, and that cuts me to these particular lines passing through the Brillouin zone. Additionally, we're limited in what circumference we can go to by entanglement growth. So if we assume that our state obeys the area law, if I look at a cylinder circumference L, then the entanglement across a cut is going to scale with that length L. And therefore, the bond dimension I need is going to scale as the exponential of L. And this, in practice, limits us to L of approximately 6 or less. OK, so I'm not using just DMRG, but in fact, a relatively new technique, which is a DMRG in a mixed real and momentum space basis. So as an example, let's suppose we had a square lattice on a cylinder like this. Here I've just taken 12 sites. Then what we can do is we can Fourier transform in just one direction, in the direction around the cylinder, to go to momentum space. And then we'll end up replacing our states in the effective one-dimensional model from being labeled by x and y to x and the momentum in the y direction. So a benchmark for this from the Hofstadter model is in this paper from my collaborator. And this shows a comparison between a real space DMRG and a k-space DMRG to studying the same model. And the result is that as you go to large bond dimension, they both converge to the same ground state energy, but that in doing so, for a given bond dimension, the k-space version uses both much less computation time and much less memory. So
free fermions.
Free fermions with magnetic field, that's right.
So
yeah.
We're using DMRG like adapted to two dimensions rather than other, say, tensor networks like PEPs.
Yes.
What's the advantage in doing that?
Essentially, the algorithms for optimizing the states are very efficient. So like with PEPs optimization, you can typically get to bond dimensions of like order 10 or something like that, 20, I don't know. And you'll see that I go to bond dimensions over 10,000. I mean, you need larger bond dimensions also because there's more entanglement because it's not just single sites, but this is comparable or better in accuracy. OK, so to put this mixed space DMRG on the triangular lattice, it's actually very dependent on which boundary conditions we choose. So as I showed you earlier, the full Brillouin zone of this triangular lattice is just this hexagon. But then if I want to go to momentum space and switch to label my states by these k quantum numbers, the number of values of k I can use depends on what boundary conditions I choose. So for example, the so-called YC boundary conditions are with one lattice vector running along the circumference of the cylinder. And that's going to give me these cuts to the Brillouin zone that I show here. And then you can make other choices by identifying this point star with the points labeled 1, 2, and 3. So if I want a cylinder of circumference 4, those are the only three choices I can have. And so these are the three sets of cuts to the Brillouin zone that I get. And you can find how many conserved momenta there are by sort of tiling these hexagons and seeing how many unique lines you have that cut through the plane. And what you find is that that number is 4, in other words, L, for these YC boundary conditions. For the so-called XC boundary conditions, it's just 2. And for these other random ones in between, it often gets you absolutely nothing. So we're going to use this YC boundary condition because it's the optimal choice given this mixed momentum and real space scheme.
So there's, confused about something. So the original model is just triangular lattice in 2D with whatever boundary conditions you want, and now you're choosing a particular set of boundary conditions just to implement this numerically.
That's right.
Okay, and then you're making this mix between momentum and real space, which for me is very reminiscent of how you treat, say, chiral states of matter, like when you have, field theory of a chiral electron, there's like a mixed representation between both. So I'm not sure what I'm going to ask makes sense or not, but is there a possibility that by just using that mixed representation, you're introducing the chirality in the system by hand?
So,
like being in a,
I understand your question. It's a good question. So, I don't think that's true because we don't. I think that if it would introduce some chirality, I would think it would introduce a bias towards one chirality over the other one, right? And we don't see that. So, I think that that's strong evidence that it's not artificially introduced. And also, we're are still able to converge to expected non-chiral states as well. So it's,
So I think related to this comment, when you have external magnetic field, you have emergent one-dimensionality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't matter which way you apply the magnetic field. So you may be biasing chirality either way by this choice of one-dimensional. That's what you are saying.
Yeah, okay, that's,
okay.
Yeah, so as you were saying. Maybe we can come back to this later, Okay, so I'm now going to try to show you the phase diagram that we found for this model and show you the three phases. So before I show you any actual results, I'm going to tell you what I expect to find. And so at u equals 0, we can, of course, solve this model exactly. And we find there's a nearly circular Fermi surface shown here in the Biron zone. And it's a metallic state. As u goes to infinity, we can do perturbation theory, and t over u reduces to the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model at half filling. And then you get this 120-degree ordered state. In between, we expect some kind of non-magnetic insulating phase. And there's, as I said earlier, various candidates for what that might be. Okay, so I'm going to begin by looking at a cylinder with circumference 4. And I'm going to show you that we find this phase diagram with a metal and non-magnetic insulator and spin-ordered phase as expected, with transitions around u over t equals 8.5 and 10.6. And I'm going to begin by looking at this higher u transition. So the first piece of evidence comes from the correlation length that we calculate from the matrix product states. And you can see sort of the sharpest feature here is a large peak at this point, which this vertical line is at u equals 10.6. So that's probably indicative of some kind of transition. We can also look at the spin ordering. So if we calculate the spin structure factor, it's a Fourier transform of the spin-spin correlation, then I'm showing here just representative values at low u over t and high u over t. And the color bars are the same on both. So it's not immediately obvious comparison. But here you can see it's relatively uniform throughout the Biron zone. And here there's large peaks at these four points. And those points are quite close to the corners of the Biron zone, which are where we'd expect them to be for the 120-degree ordered phase. And so in fact, with the allowed momentum cuts through the Biron zone, these are as close as possible as you can get to those points. We can also see the same transition that we saw over here by looking at the maximum value of the spin structure factor throughout the Biron zone. If I plot this maximum value as a function of u over t, I see that it jumps up at the same value. So this vertical line here is the same place as this one. So it's a pretty strong sign that this is, in fact, some kind of spin ordering transition. OK, so to look at the first transition, that is kind of harder to see. So what I want to look at for that is the entanglement in the system. So I can take my cylinder and divide it into two regions, called A and B, and perform the Schmidt decomposition on that partition with some set of Schmidt coefficients lambda. And then the von Neumann entanglement entropy is just defined by the sum of lambda squared log lambda squared. With a finite bond dimension in my matrix product state, this sum is cut off, doesn't go to infinity, but instead only to the finite value chi. And then as a function of this chi, I can plot the entanglement across some cut as a function of u over t. And this is the result. So you can see that, again, at this same point where we previously identified the transition, we see this kink in the entanglement. And there's still no obvious feature around here. But we can reveal that such a feature actually is there by looking at how this entanglement scales with bond dimension. So the idea is to use finite entanglement scaling. And there's two versions of it. The first, just directly from conformal field theory, this entanglement should scale with the log of the correlation length, with coefficient being the central charge c. And when we calculate that using this entanglement, the correlation length in the previous slide, what we find is that it's roughly constant in some region until u approximately 8. And then it starts to fall, and then it seems to be close to 0 around in this high u region. But you can also look at the dependence on the bond dimension. And you'll see that it appears to be basically converged here, whereas everywhere from here to the right, it seems to be dropping rapidly. And so the reason why is that here, we are actually in a gapless state. It's in a metal. So this formula should work well. But in this region, both in the center and on the right, you can see the entanglement is basically converged with bond dimension. And so is the correlation length. So scaling them with each other doesn't work very well. So I'll come back. Sorry, I forgot one thing, but I'll come back to in a second. So to compare these with each other, a better choice is to do the scaling of entanglement directly with bond dimension using this result. And when we do that, we see the central charge in the high U region is exactly 0, and in the intermediate region seems to be 0, at least for the upper part of it. And the lower part, it's dropping to 0 as you increase bond dimension. So one other thing I want to mention is the value of central charge that we get in the metal appears to be C equals 6. And that's exactly what we should expect for this state. Because as you can see, this is the U equals 0 Fermi surface that I've shown here. And the allowed momentum cluster of the Brillouin zone, you see exactly 3 of them pass through. So it's effectively like 3 1D systems, each of which has a spinful fermion. That would give C equals 6.
So these results are valid for CFTs, or you can extend them to non-CFTs?
So the results are both valid for CFTs, and then if a state is gaps, then this S should converge with the bond dimension, in which case we'd get 0 in this result. So as long as it's a gapless state, this picture should be accurate. And if it's a gap state, then this picture should be accurate.
So that's the ground state in the momentum zero center.
Yes, that's right.
I'm going to look at the other center.
Right, so this is in the momentum pi sector here. This is the one where the DMRG didn't, I told you earlier, the DMRG didn't converge that well for the momentum pi sector. So I don't really have good results for that.
Yeah, and another question regarding the small line that you have over there. So the transition at 10.6, I can understand that from like breaking SU2 symmetry, right, from left to the right. And then the one at 8.5, is there a local order parameter for that transition, or should I understand this as a non-conventional?
I will show you that there is a local order parameter, so you'll see what that is shortly. It's also sort of non-conventional, but there is an order parameter. Did you have another question? No. All right. So another thing we can look at with the entanglement is not just this sum, but actually the full set of values of lambda, in other words, the entanglement spectrum. So here I'm showing the entanglement spectrum, just the most significant values of lambda, the larger Schmidt coefficients, as a function of u over t. And I've colored these levels by their degeneracy. So blue levels are non-degenerate, yellow levels are twofold, and so forth. And what you see is that there's essentially three regimes of behavior. In this leftmost region, there are non-degenerate levels. And then once I pass this line, every level is at least twofold degenerate. And then beyond this line, every level is at least fourfold degenerate. So these are two pretty clear transitions. And this is really how we can identify the locations of these transitions precisely.
So do you understand why you get degeneracy in the entanglement spectrum?
For this one, definitely yes. As I'll show you later, it's from the semion sector of the chiral spin liquid.
I see.
Yeah. For this one, it seems to carry over the same degeneracy plus an extra degeneracy from reflection symmetry, but that one I don't have a complete understanding of. So to really confirm the locations of these lines, what you can do is you can look at, you can sort of pair up all these levels. So take the lowest two and the next two and the next two and the next two and so forth, and look at the separations between all the pairs. And then look at that as a function of bond dimension versus u over t. And so until around somewhere around 8.3, 8.4, 8.5, this separation doesn't depend on bond dimension. And then suddenly, the separation starts going to zero as I increase the bond dimension. So that's how I can identify this point as exactly where it becomes twofold degenerate. And then, of course, doing the same thing with the fourfold degeneracy is much sharper because this transition has been easier to observe all along, and this separation suddenly drops to zero. OK, so there's a couple additional signatures that are useful to look at. One of them is the occupation of states in the Brillouin zone as a function of u or t. And so from this, we can hopefully see a singularity at the Fermi surface for the metallic phase and not at the others. And so this is an exact calculation for u over t equals 0. And then these three are from the numerics. So at u over t equals 6, this is not actually singular. This is at a finite bond dimension. But as the bond dimension increases, the maximum gradient appears to be diverging. So it does look like there's a singularity. Once we get to u over t equals 9, that's no longer true. And same for u over t equals 12. OK, and that now I'm going to answer your question about the local order parameter. So we can also look at this scalar chiral order parameter. This is how you can detect spontaneous time reversal symmetry breaking. If you look at any triangle in the lattice, we can calculate this S dot S cross S relation function. And this is the result that we find. So for each finite bond dimension, this is small in the low U phase, and then becomes quite large, and then drops abruptly to zero at this second transition. But then if we do an extrapolation in the bond dimension, actually, its extrapolation is in the DMRG truncation error, but it's roughly the same, then it extrapolates almost exactly to zero. It actually extrapolates to a slightly negative value, which is not physical, but it's approximately zero until around 8.3 or 8.4, and then it suddenly comes up. So this is sort of a local order parameter that distinguishes this phase from this phase, at least in the limit of infinite bond dimension. OK, and so this is also a hint about the chirality that I'm going to tell you about shortly. OK, so yeah. So what I'm showing here is actually the absolute value. So the sign is not biased. So yeah. So actually, some of these points are positive and some of them are negative. And I take the absolute value, and they all lie on a curve. And
so this is not yet long range order. This is fluctuating chirality.
It is long range. So if I calculate this on any triangle in the lattice, I get the same value.
Right, but you take the magnitude.
Yeah, well, no, this magnitude is taken over samples, not spatially. So spatially, on any triangle, for any given wave function that I calculate, any given ground state wave function, this is going to be equal in magnitude and sign on any triangle in the lattice.
I see. So you're insured.
But this is because for some values of u over t, it converges to the opposite chirality uniformly over the whole state. But
so as the variational theory, you get this or that.
That's right. I get one or the other. And that's why I've taken the absolute value. OK, so I can also look at the phase diagram for a circumference 6 cylinder. And here, the story is less clear just because as I said earlier, the amount of the bond dimension I need to get the same accuracy is going to scale exponentially with circumference. So in this case, I would need a bond dimension 16 times larger. And if you look at what I have here, I've already gone to 10,000. So I'm not going to get anywhere near bond dimension 160,000. In fact, I'm just going to go up to 10,000 again. And so that means the results are going to be much less clear. But in fact, one thing we find that's very nice now, we didn't find for L equals 4, is that we find two different low energy states in different sectors of momentum around the ring. And so if I compare the energies of those two states, then here I'm showing the energy of the k equals 0 sector minus the energy of the energy of the k equals pi sector minus the energy of the k equals 0 sector. And so it's positive in this region until u of around 8 and decreasing in u. So there we can clearly say that k equals 0 is the ground state sector. And then in this central region, between from u about 8 to u about 10, the two are pretty similar in energy. And it's constant with respect to u over t. And also appears to be decreasing with bond dimension, although the extrapolation is not totally clear. And then for u larger than 10, it appears that this k equals pi sector has become the ground state. So this degeneracy here is, in fact, meaningful, which I'll demonstrate, hopefully convincingly, in a few minutes. But the first evidence for that comes from looking, again, at the spin order. So I can calculate the spin structure factor in the ground state at various values of u over t. And what you can see is that at u over 6, there's essentially no ordering whatsoever. That's in the middle. At u equals 9, which is in the middle of this central region, there is a little bit of ordering, but it's still a disordered state. But the relevant thing is that these two sectors, k equals 0 and k equals pi, have essentially the exact same spin structure factor. So that shows that there's something similar about these two states, not just their energy. And then in the high u phase, my allowed cuts to the Brillouin zone for L equals 6 now pass through these corners of the Brillouin zone where I expect to have the peaks in the spin structure factor, and indeed I observe them. And that also corresponds to the real space spin-spin correlations. So what I'm showing here is S dot S correlations from this point to every other point in the lattice where red is positive and blue is negative. And you'll see it has the three sublattice order that you expect. Okay, so now I can calculate the maximum value of the spin structure factor as a function of u over t, just like before. And I find that in the ground state, which is k equals 0 up until around here, there's very little ordering. And then in the region where the two states are similar in energy, they also have similar magnetic order. And then k equals pi becomes the ground state, and the magnetic ordering jumps up. So it looks qualitatively similar to L equals 4 case.
Sorry, what is the conclusion?
But it's what?
You need to say that in that regime, you have coexisting long range order and chirality.
Which one?
Yeah, in that between 8 and 10.
Between 8 and 10, I'm saying that there are two different low energy states.
Low energy, I mean, two different ground states?
Two different ground states. Well, I'm saying low energy states because their energies are not exactly the same. They're set different by like a third of a percent or something like that. But
so what distinguishes them physically?
You'll see that in a minute.
OK.
Yes. OK, so now I've identified that there's some sort of non-magnetic insulating phase for L equals 4, and that it's a non-magnetic phase at least for L equals 6. And now I'm going to tell you that it's a chiral spin. Okay, so before I do that, I should review what exactly it is I'm looking for. So a chiral spin liquid is basically a nu equals 1 half fractional quantum Hall effect state for spins, which has a number of consequences. So one of them is time reversal symmetry breaking, which is shown by the scalar chiral order parameter, which I already showed you that indeed there is this time reversal symmetry breaking. And then there's two different chiralities, which we should find that should give a 2x ground state degeneracy. Then there should also be additional topological ground state degeneracy and corresponding fractionalized quasiparticles. So on the infinite cylinder, which is equivalent to a torus, this should be a 2x degeneracy. Between the trivial sector and the so-called semion sector, where we create a pair of these semions. And if we're on a torus, I would drag them around the torus and reconnect them to get this topological string. On the infinite cylinder, I just drag them out to infinity. and that switches me into the semion sector. We should also have chiral edge modes. So if I had a two-dimensional sample with an edge, I would have some chiral, some gapless mode that runs around the edge. And on the cylinder, that will show up in the entanglement spectrum when I make a cut through the cylinder. And that should have some characteristic counting of the low energy states, like 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, et cetera. And the entanglement spectrum in the semion sector should be exactly two-fold degenerate. Furthermore, I should observe a quantized spin Hall effect, which I can see by doing flux pumping through this cylinder. And that should pump some spin 1 half along the cylinder. And I'll show you now that indeed we see all of these things. So the first is the chiral order parameter. I already showed you this for L equals 4. This is just the same thing. We can also do the same thing for L equals 6. Here, again, the story is less clear just because it's harder to get as much precision. But you can see that if I look in the actual ground state in the high U phase, then the chiral order has gone exactly to 0, just like in L equals 4. In the intermediate phase, it's roughly of similar magnitude in both of the two momentum sectors. In the low U phase, where this is the ground state, it's still non-zero, but it's dropping rapidly. And unfortunately, we can't go to high enough bond dimension to really resolve it. But presumably, we'll do the same thing that happened for L equals 4.
So which state has a lower energy?
The blue arrow indicates the ground state. So like, this is the ground state, and the upper one's ground state here, and the lower one's ground state here. And this is the region where the two are similar in energy. OK, so this is the big smoking gun, is to look at the entanglement spectrum resolved by spin and momentum. So what you'll see is that in the k equals 0 sector, what this is showing is sort of momentum around the ring. In particular, when I take my cut through the cylinder, it's effectively the momentum of the edge mode that's running around. And I've also resolved it by the spin quantum numbers. And you can see that here, all of the spin quantum numbers are integers. That's because this is in the trivial sector, so fundamental excitations are still full spin flip, so like triplet spin excitations. On the other hand, in the k equals pi sector, all of the spin quantum numbers are half integer, and that's because I've pumped spin half to each end of the cylinder, so every time I cut, I'm cutting the string and ending with spin 1 half mode at the edge. So this corresponds to the trivial sector and to the semion sector. And the low energy levels also have the expected counting. So if we look at the degeneracy of the SZ equals 0 modes, there's 1.123 sort of below this gap. And then beyond that, it becomes a little bit hard to see due to microscopics. And then the same thing is true if I look at the higher spins. So I count spin 1, I get 1, 1, 2, 3, et cetera. And then I can get the same counting in the semion sector as well. So essentially, these match, at least for the lowest energy states, basically precisely what you expect for a chiral spin market. OK, I also promised you that I should find ground state degeneracy, and indeed I do. So I've already shown you that the k equals 0 and k equals pi sectors for the circumference 6 cylinder are effectively degenerate. So that's this twofold degeneracy in the top row and the bottom row. And then to go back to what you were saying earlier, so in fact, what I've done to get both different chiralities is for each value of u over t, I initialize the DMRG with 10 random product states. And half of them, on average, will converge to one chirality, and the other half will converge to the other chirality. And the energy different gap between these is never more than like 0.01%. So another thing we can do is look at flux insertion and the spin Hall effect. So if I apply a spin flux, so I've written this as magnetic field, but it acts oppositely on spin up and spin down electrons. I transform my Hamiltonian by twisting the boundary conditions. And as a result, I can go from, say, the zero flux state in the k equals pi sector. And once I insert 2 pi flux, it converts it into the trivial sector, an additional 2π flux converts back into the semion sector. So this is, again, what we expect. So basically here, we've started with this semion topological string, and then here I've created a pair of semions and annihilated the string, and here I've put it back again. As a result, we can get additionally a quantized spin Hall effect. So what I'm actually, when I say spin pump, what I really mean is I can use the entanglement spectrum on a cut to look at the total spin on, say, the left half-infinite cylinder and the right half-infinite cylinder. And then I see how that number changes as I insert the flux. And over 4 pi flux, it changes by exactly 1. OK, so yeah.
There's another smoking gun for this, is that if it's really a new, it could 1/2 field version of a Hall state, you could look at, I don't know, like the whole resistivity, right, for this particular system. If you plug, like, I don't know, turn on some electric field or whatever, have you guys looked at that for that particular chiral spin liquid phase and see what you get?
We have not, so.
Okay. Yeah. Is it feasible, or do you think it?
That's exactly equivalent.
Right. But to do it, like, do that explicitly, no. But this is like from sort of like Laughlin's like flux pumping argument. This should be equivalent to that, right? So.
Then, yeah.
I
that's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So, these are all the signatures that I promised you I would show you. And so now we can try to use this state to say something about the experimental results that I told you. So I mentioned this puzzle that the heat capacity appears to be gapless and the thermal conductivity appears to be gapped, right? And so we may have a solution to this, which is you could imagine a state which has sort of puddles of different chirality, and there's some gapless edge modes that are on the edges between the two different chiralities. And if they're below some kind of percolation threshold, it would be conceivable that you get some heat capacity from those edge modes. But since they don't percolate, they wouldn't actually be able to conduct. And so you would observe this combination of gapless heat capacity and gapped conductivity. So that's one possible explanation. There's an additional feature in the experiments, which is kind of strange, that at some low finite temperature, around like 4 or 5 or 6 Kelvin, there's this peak in the thermal conductivity. And so that might be an interesting feature to try to explain. And one thought is that it could correspond to some kind of phase transition. So it could be, for example, an Ising-like ordering transition for these two different chiralities. And if so, one thing we can look at is the domain wall tension between the two different chiralities. So to do that, I can take states from one chirality and the opposite chirality and use the infinite matrix product state corresponding to each one of them with some set of tensors in the middle that I'm going to optimize over. So I fix sort of the left infinite cylinder and the right infinite cylinder, and then I optimize the center. And when I do that, I find this result for this S dot S cross S expectation value. The result, and so here I'm showing the two different triangle orientations just to confirm for you that they're the same. Note that they're a little bit offset, but that's basically because this right-pointing triangle, as I've labeled it, is actually somewhat farther to the left than the left-pointing one. So it follows this nice curve, and I also look at this with respect to the MPS bond dimension. You'll see that it's basically converged. So the energy of this, which I find by taking the energy of either one of these original ground states, which are degenerate, and then taking the energy of this optimized state with the domain wall and subtracting them, that gives me an energy for the domain wall. And I can divide by the circumference of the cylinder, and that gives me a domain wall tension of around 4 Kelvin. So that is the same order of magnitude as this finite temperature feature. So it may be related, although I don't want to claim that it necessarily. I don't want to make too strong a claim, but I think it might be related. OK, so to summarize what I've told you, we studied the Chiang-Gerardus-Hubbard model, finding a metallic phase at low U, evidenced by, for example, the central charge. being exactly as expected, and this what looks like a singularity at the Fermi surface. At high U, we found this spin-ordered phase with peaks in the spin structure factor at the expected points, and with this expected real space ordering. And in the intermediate phase, we found a chiral spin liquid as identified by this scalar order parameter, by the characteristic level counting in the entanglement spectrum, by the quantized spin Hall effect. And then we also looked at some consequences, including the chiral domain. So this is sort of what has been done so far. And now before I finish, I want to say a few words about what I'm working on now and what other things are interesting to study here. So one thing that we would like to calculate is the actual spin gap in the chiral spin liquid phase. And one way of calculating this, given that we have this, so if you had a finite cylinder, what you would do is you would just flip one spin and then find the new lowest energy and subtract them. That's the spin gap, right? But we can't do that because we're on an infinite cylinder. So one way of dealing with that is to flip one spin per segment of some length n rings, and then to extrapolate and limit n goes to infinity. So here I'm showing you as results. This is for the L equals 4 cylinder of as a function of u over t, and as a function of this segment width of the change in energy. And what you see is that the spin gap appears to be somewhere around the order of t squared over u in this chiral spin liquid phase here. And so t squared over u is like j over 4 in terms of the Heisenberg coupling. So that's a pretty sizable spin gap. However, the reason why this is not a finished result is because the metallic phase is still quite messy, and I need to do further work to refine those results. So I don't quite understand what's going on here and want to understand that better. A second version uses a similar approach to the chiral domain wall calculation, where we can fix both the left and the right infinite cylinders to basically the ground state. And then in the center region, we flip one spin and optimize. And we do that. The results, this is, again, very preliminary data, so it looks a little bit messy at the moment. But you can see that qualitatively, we get the same result that we had here. Yeah, so again, I don't really understand exactly what's going on in this metallic phase. And so it's preliminary. Take it with a grain of salt for now. But roughly, there appears to be a nice large spin gap. OK, so another thing that I'm working on at the moment is calculating the effects of hopping anisotropy. So this real material has some anisotropy. As I told you earlier, estimates for t prime over t are like anywhere from the range of 0.8 to like 1.06, or even a little bit more than that. And so it will be useful to calculate a phase diagram not just as a function of u over t, but also as t prime over t to get a better model of the real materials. One additional reason for doing this is that if I look at my cylinder, you see that these two hoppings are sort of symmetrical. But this one is already picked out as distinct by the fact that it goes around the cylinder, right? And so one might think that effectively putting on a cylinder has already created some effective anisotropy, and that by studying anisotropy explicitly, we can sort of correct for this and maybe get a better understanding of the two-dimensional limit.
So have you measured, let's say, nearest neighbor spin-spin correlation functions to say whether you have any such problem or not?
So there is anisotropy. So yeah, so the anisotropy, like viewing this as one triangle, for example, the correlation functions from like along this direction are not the same. Okay. So there is anisotropy.
So how large is this?
I don't know the values offhand. Yeah. So, and it also varies as a function of u over t. So, in fact, which one is larger crosses over at some point. So, it's a little bit complicated. Okay. So, in this phase diagram, part of it we've already done, which is when t prime over t equals 1, we have the metallic phase, the chiral spin liquid, and the 120 degree ordered phase. And then, of course, at t prime over t equals 0, we just get a square lattice. So that it'll have a metallic phase and the nail ordered phase. And then in between, it's not known what exactly is going to happen here. So this is, I think, an interesting question to look at, partly for the reason I said earlier that it'll help us correct for this two-dimensional limit and the anisotropy, partly because there should be some interesting phase transitions here from, you know, between different magnetic ordered phases, from the Naoh state to the chiral spin liquid, and so forth. And additionally, it might give us more insight about the nature of these phase transitions. If, for example, there's some extra phase that appears, like in a triangle here, that ends at this point, that would be quite interesting. I don't know if that's true. I'm not claiming that, but it's a possibility.
So for square matrix, people have done Monte Carlo simulations, right?
Yeah.
So what do they find?
I mean, just along this line.
Yeah, along this line.
As far as I know, this is the phase there. There's just the metallic phase and then okay. Transition to the Naoh phase.
And is the transition continuous?
I don't remember, actually.
There's in the transition from metal to Naoh ordering, there's no chiral symmetry breaking, right? Or is there?
No, there's not.
Okay, so it would be interesting to see how that point where you have the chiral symmetry breaking connects to
exactly right
to the.
Yes. I guess that's sort of what I was going for with this.
Right.
Yeah, and exactly.
At those two points where you have the T prime equals T, have you looked at the critical exponents of each transition? Is it like feasible to do with?
That's not really feasible, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, so if you look, at the end of the talk, I can go back to the correlation length picture, but you can see that it's. As I increase the bond dimension, it's scaling in a kind of erratic way, almost. So, it's definitely increasing, but the way in which it's increasing is not that clear. Yeah. So I'll go back and show you that at the end. Okay. So the last thing before I finish is I wanted to talk about an extension of this mixed-based DMRG approach. So on the triangle lattice, I used this. It was quite helpful because we got an extra quantum number to use, which gave us some computational efficiency in the calculations, and also let us find the ground state in a specific momentum sector quite easily. But it can be even more useful than that. So one example is we can consider something like twisted bilayer graphene, which has this real space moiré pattern, and a very large real space unit cell, as shown by this triangle. And so that unit cell is going to be far too large to actually use DMRG. That's because the entanglement is going to be grow way too much, and this is impractical. Or so it seems. But I'm going to claim that this mixed-based DMRG actually can make this problem potentially accessible. So it's generally believed that once you find the band structure of this twisted bilayer graphene, actually, only these flat bands in the center are really important to the physics. And as a result, you can basically do this Fourier transform and then throw away all of the information except for the flat bands. And once you do that, you can use some Wannier states that are localized in real space in one direction, but maintain k-space in the other direction. And from this band structure calculation, you can extract hopping coefficients and interaction terms as a function of the different momenta and real space locations that are involved. And then once you do that, you can automatically generate a matrix product operator to run DMRG, and then hopefully compress it, because it's going to end up being quite large. And then this will put you into this mixed real momentum space picture, where the momentum space came from our type binding model, and the real space came from the transition to these Fourier states. And so hopefully this will make this accessible to DMRG. And this is something which I'm working on now in collaboration with other people at Berkeley and also at MIT and at the Technical University of Munich. OK, so with that, I'll acknowledge my collaborators on this chiral spin liquid project. That's Johannes Motruk, who's a postdoc at Berkeley, and Mike Zalatel and Joel Moore, who's my PhD advisor. They're both professors at Berkeley. Also, for the DMRG, I used this 10pi code, which was originally written by Frank Pullman and Mike Zalatel and Roger Meng, and also computing resources. All this was done at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. So with that, I'll put up my summary, and thanks for your attention.
Some questions?
in the Hubbard model, external magnetic field can induce chirality term, mm-hmm. the effective, right?
Yeah.
So are there experimental, any significant change in behavior as a function of magnetic field, like magnetization plateau or?
So the experiments applying magnetic fields don't actually show a very significant change in behavior, as far as I know. So like, there's some experiments that go to like 10 Tesla, I think, fields. And they claim that it doesn't show any change in behavior for, say, the thermal conductivity. Although the figure, I don't have a picture of it, but the figure they use to claim that, to me, their interpretation is not obvious from their data. Like, to me, it looks like it's unclear whether it did something or not, but they claim that did not do anything.
What about theory? Theoretically.
So theoretically, one thing that I've done is to look at, you know, if you apply a magnetic field and you induce a certain, like, so from the value of the scalar chiral order parameter that I calculated, you can calculate what the energy splitting should be between the two different chiralities, right? And what I found is that you kind of expect not to see very much would happen because the energy splitting between them is so small that even at like 1 Kelvin or something like that, you would end up still with only like 1% extra of one chirality versus the other or something like that. This is just a rough approximation, but that was roughly what I found. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I have a number in my paper that says this is the number, so you can look at it there. So you wanted to?
No, just one last thing. Out of curiosity, has anybody tried to do this with Monte Carlo, or there's a sign problem?
There's a sign problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
So could you go back to the slides about the experiments?
There one at the end here.
Yeah.
This one.
Yeah. A few questions.
Yeah,
so
sure.
First is that for this gapless heat capacity.
Yeah.
So what's the power for the experiments?
The power of temperature?
Yeah.
They claim it's linear in T.
Linear.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So that's there's the vertical axis is specific heat over T.
Okay.
Right. And so there's a gap from zero. So that's linear in T.
So if you want to interpret using this gapless chiral modes, so what's the power?
I think it should also be linear in T.
Is it universal or it's?
So actually, I don't remember exactly how the calculation goes, but I think there's a paper from Wen, I believe, that claims that this is linear in T, but
okay.
Right. Yeah, I don't remember for sure.
Secondly, for this thermal transition.
Yeah.
So since there are disorders in the system, should I just think the first transitions as a clean version of Ising transition or some disorder dominant phenomena?
What I looked at with the Carolinian wall is equivalent to a clean transition. The effects of disorder, the disorder probably pins domains.
Yeah.
But exactly what effect that has a transition, I'm not exactly sure.
So in your scenario, those domains does not proliferate, does not collate, right?
Right.